Bob Scully's World Show is brought to you by Fiera Capital. The power of thinking, optimal performance, intelligent innovation.
Hi, this is Bob Scully, and welcome to another edition of the World Show, Free Markets, the Fiera Series. Quick, name a country that in the 80s and 90s changed its economic destiny forever, for the better, and it has lasted to this day. Now, you could say China, you'd be right on some counts. You could say America, you'd be right again on some counts. Canada, Germany, Australia, many. But if you said New Zealand, you'd be right on all counts, and it's a spectacular achievement. New Zealand fought its way out of the doldrums and has never gone back there since. And one of the people responsible for that is our guest this week, who was Minister of Finance at the time, Ruth Richardson. Here she is. Ruth Richardson, the millennials watching us may find this a surprise, but anybody following economics and the world of politics in the 80s and 90s and who's watching would remember that New Zealand was a shining beacon. It was a spectacular reversal of its economic and political fate. And it had a father and a mother, and you were the Margaret Thatcher, they said, the author of Ruth in Asia. What happened?
Don't use that word. Okay, what no, do you I was mean? Just no labels.
All right, no labels. But you were certainly at the outset, along with your colleague from the opposing party, responsible for that. First of all, what was it, this revolution?
Well, the millennials would understand disruption, and this was disruption meeting politics only in the late 80s, early 90s. And I went into politics to conduct a free market insurgency. It was about a status quo that was discredited, and I wanted to be an activist in the cause of liberating the economy and securing a basis of freedom as the principle that would drive all policy. And the really interesting thing was that my party had been more meddling, more socialist than any socialist party. And Sir Roger Douglas, who was the first reforming minister, had been socialist in his DNA and by birth.
He was Labour, you were National.
Yes.
He was officially left, you were officially right.
In theory, but my party had deviated in favour of socialism, and he led radical market reform. So we had an era where philosophical deviancy was the norm. We both stepped outside what had been the approach and template of our parties, and we did so for a good and compelling reason. There was a burning platform. New Zealand needed desperately to address policy malfunction and economic, if you like, disorder at every level, and it was a time for radical activism, and that's what Sir Roger and I gave the country.
And radical activism in power, that's what's astounding. A lot of idealistic politicians who come in with a good set of things they want to achieve, inevitably they're bogged down pretty quickly by the press, by controversies, by the opposition, whatever, interest groups. You tackled all of that, and it worked. That's what's astounding to us looking from the outside. You had the unions against you. You had even accountants with their standards against you. You had obviously the opposition. You had all kinds of groups ready to whack you. And they didn't succeed.
Well, it took both courage on our part, spine was a critical part of the exercise, but more importantly were the ideas that drove the reform. This was a coherent sweep. This was a set of reforms that were compelling. They had coherence. And Roger Douglas and I chose to use our political capital on Big Bang reform. I mean, not for us, gradualism, incrementalism. We knew we had one shot at securing a massive game-changing set of policies. We went for the gold standard. We didn't settle for second-order, second-class type reforms. And having transformed the landscape, New Zealand understood what free markets delivered. They liked it. They kept on voting governments in that supported the new template. And I think the experience of both Sir Roger Douglas and myself demonstrates that reform is not a one-night stand. You know, you really have to persist if you're going to secure a permanently new paradigm for public policy.
And any time that's been tried, something similar in Quebec province in Canada or in Wisconsin in the U.S., whenever reforms of that radical are tried, they get sandbagged by violent opposition. By violent, I don't mean specific, you know, attacks, but just demonstrations in the streets and constant harassing from editorials and so on. How can you withstand that and still get to your goal?
Well, you withstand that because you have a conviction. We were both conviction politicians. You understand what needs to be done, and you're confident that results will demonstrate that these reforms can yield success. So early labour market reform, when I first took office, yielded the highest rate of job growth in the OECD. I took a huge, huge scythe to public expenditure, halved some welfare benefits, and within a year, our interest rates, which had been in double digits when I first took office, were in single digits and falling. So people could see that there were concrete results for the radical reforms. And so you authenticate the reforms. Nothing encourages a politician like concrete success.
Of course. So the results came quickly enough to help you, to save you. In other words, the population saw that it made sense. If it had not made sense within 5 or 6 years, they might have dropped you.
In the first instance for Roger Douglas, it was more difficult because there was just the broadest sweep of radical reform, and my party was in denial. And Douglas and his colleagues won a second election. We only have a 3-year term, so it's quite limiting.
No.
In the second election, they got a more substantial majority than when they were first elected because of the state of denial of my party. My party had to get with the program. So I was very lucky that I was able to have Roger pass me the baton and address public sector reforms that he was not able to achieve inside his own party. I mean, a Labour Party cannot do labour market reform.
No, obviously, yeah. When the name like that.
Yeah, sure.
And did you have showdowns? I'm trying to imagine the unions, for instance. You instituted the right to choose your union, or the right to what we call right to work here, but in a modified form. That's one of the most radical things you can do unionize workers.
Yeah, no, not just choose your union. Choose not to be in a union at all.
Yeah, right.
Freedom to work. Freedom for contract.
So I can picture the union heads, who are powerful people, going to your boss, the Prime Minister, and saying, hey, get this girl out of the way.
We had sufficient of a team of believers. We knew that our controlled labour market arrangements were a job destruction machine. And one of our platforms was, we want to liberate the labour market. We did it quickly. A big part of success was within 6 weeks of taking office, I had introduced the most comprehensive free-to-work regime anywhere in the world. And all the naysayers said, you know, you're going to kill jobs. That's the static. The dynamic was it unleashed a labour market capable of the fullest employment in the Western world. And what was the price I paid? In terms of the unions, all they could muster were the odd demonstration in the street.
I think no general strikes?
No. I think I got a very nice suit ruined by some paint splattered all over it. But apart from that, we took the high ground. I mean, the communication's very important. And the high ground was, if we stick with a controlled regime, you are shutting people out of the workforce. It is destroying jobs. We must have a game changer. And the public agreed.
And what proportion decided to stick to be unionized, and what proportion decided to leave?
The country was compulsory unionism virtually writ large. I think of firms that I'm now involved with where of a workforce of, say, 340, two are union members. I think on average it's below 10%.
So it really shrank.
Yeah, but you think about it from not just a finance minister's point of view, but a feminist point of view. So agriculture is a big deal in the New Zealand economy.
Yes,
we now
yes.
have agriculture without subsidies. The best paying jobs in our slaughterhouses were on the slaughter floor. The union decreed that wasn't appropriate work for women. Women were consigned to jobs that were paid half the amount. So it wasn't just the finance minister and me that wanted to liberate the labour market. It was the feminist as well.
And were you inspired? You've been compared to Margaret Thatcher, of course, many, many times. Were you inspired by what she did with the printers' unions and so on when she came in? And there were some newspaper barons that, of course, were happy and helped her. But still, she had the railroad unions. Margaret Thatcher took them all on. That was in the past. When you were doing this, that had already happened.
Yes.
Were you inspired by it?
No, I was inspired by first principles of what a good free labour market code could look for. But of course, I was impressed by her conviction. I understood where she had moved effectively with privatisation and areas she hadn't touched. Mm-hmm. I was far more rigorous in the control of public expenditure than Margaret Thatcher ever managed to be. You have a time and an opportunity. So the enduring conviction was the DNA, and the enduring idea was faith in markets and prices. And to that extent, we're on the same page.
And either before, during, or after, did you ever discuss it with her?
I first met Margaret Thatcher. She'd been the leader of the opposition for 3 weeks. She came to New Zealand and Australia, which were economic disgraces. Mm-hmm. They were socialism, state intervention writ large. She gave a fire-eating speech on Russia. I was probably the only one applauding in the audience. And she then wrote in her book, you know, how economically ignorant she found our then Prime Minister, Robert Muldoon, and the Australian Prime Minister, even worse, Fraser. So she was not complimentary by what she found, and I agreed with her. I mean, it was at that time that I was determining to go into politics to effectively blow up that establishment and install market regimes.
And she must have wanted to meet the only lady in the crowd applauding. She must have. Did she go over to you?
No. It was. I met her there, but it was in her foreign policy hat. But she was hugely instrumental in changing so much of the Western world's opinion about the destructive nature of the state intervention and the real effectiveness if you trusted people to play to their instincts, to innovate on their own account. So her trust in individuals radiated public policy in the Western world.
And most defenders, active defenders of free markets, come to that after a road to Damascus or some kind of lengthy detour from the other side. And even Margaret Thatcher as a young woman was not exactly in that bag. Did you come to it gradually?
No, I've always been true north. So I was brought up in a farming family. That's quintessential New Zealand. I had a father who from an early days took me to the banker, the lawyer, the accountant. Farmers are free market. He is in New Zealand.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And from an early age, when I was 15, I decided I wanted to be a politician and it was always going to be in the free market mode. This lady was never for turning.
But Margaret Thatcher became the leader of her party. Mm-hmm. That makes it a little bit easier. You had a boss who was the Prime Minister. And he must have got lots of pressure saying, hey, calm her down.
He did. And both Roger Douglas and I suffered from bosses who were not true believers. They tolerated a reform program so long as they understood there were very, very big issues that needed to be tackled. Mm-hmm. The moment they felt that the pressure was off, they were for having a cup of tea. And when my Prime Minister decided to have a cup of tea, I said, we're out of here. I came in politics to reform. Job's not done yet. You've lost your appetite, your will. I don't respect that decision. I don't wish to remain in that environment.
And it's true that that was one of the stunning things reading your bio. You were there 3 years. And what you did is so momentous, one would have thought 10 years. You were there 3 years. Mm. And afterwards, another logical outcome would have been to fight your previous bosses and try to be the Prime Minister. You didn't want that.
No, I went into politics to pursue ideas, not to advance individuals. And one of the most important things that I wanted to do was to institutionalise the responsible conduct of public finances. You know, I was Minister of Finance when I was 39. Never in my adult lifetime had New Zealand balanced its budget, let alone dealt to its debt.
Never.
And I was very determined, first of all, to take a permanent cut to public expenditure and then to write fiscal rules that meant never again would politicians deviate from the fiscal responsibility code. So the combination of all of the public accounts being in generally accepted accounting practice, so you accounted for everything, not just cash, mm-hmm. but assets, liabilities, contingent liabilities, the discipline of high-quality public accounting with my fiscal rules about what fiscal responsibility involved changed the nature of the conduct of fiscal policy in my country forever. We're the only Western world that is now in surplus. Our public debt is under 20% of GDP. We take an investment approach to all of the public estate and portfolio. It is a very sophisticated but successful approach that locks in good fiscal behaviour. So no politician in New Zealand would now dare campaign on the basis of, I'll buy your vote with money that I don't have.
That too is stunning. Usually these things get undone over time. It's like rust. You don't see it coming. But they nick at it here and they nick at it there, and first thing you know, you're back to square one. That hasn't happened.
Yeah, well, the fiscal rules, the transparency, the accountability have all combined to conspire against that kind of reversion to type. Because there's no doubt. Look around the world. Most countries have severe fiscal problems. Our next door neighbour, Australia, public debt of $100 billion and no political will to deal with it. One of the major things I wanted to do was to complement our monetary policy setting, independent central bank, single decision maker accountable, with a fiscal policy code. And it was the first of its kind in the world. We pioneered a lot because we were confident in the ideas and the institutions that locked in those ideas.
And people wonder how long Germany, for instance, which has a fairly healthy economy, will be able to last in the sea of failures around it. You're a little bit in the same situation. If everybody else is in debt and so on, you have an export economy, how long can it sustain itself?
Well, it makes us stronger. If we have countries that are less competitive because they have poor public policy, that's an advantage. So in this current time, I'm involved in the business sector. I always thought three things matter in life: nation building, which I contributed to, business building, and the stuff on which everything is built, which is the family. Mm-hmm. But in my business building role, a company, publicly listed company, has the biggest infant formula plant in the world, built in the South Island of New Zealand. We are acing the Chinese market, among others. We are manufacturing for Australian companies who choose to do business in our country. It's a huge competitive advantage for us to leverage off that public policy setting quality.
So there's no room for nor chance of some charismatic politician coming in and saying, wow, look at this beautiful surplus that's been built up. I'm going to dole it out. And there's no chance of that.
Well, it's no surprise New Zealand is now into its 10th year of the same Prime Minister, no, eighth year of the same Prime Minister, dedicated to generally these market principles. Taxes have been reduced. There's been an iron will, commendably, by the Finance Minister to maintain the fiscal discipline. And that's now just part of our DNA. So a populist would be on their ear. They wouldn't get a hearing.
So it can be done.
It can be done, yes.
People, by and large, are sceptical that major economic reforms can be done. You're proving the opposite.
Well, New Zealand is a case study that if you have the quality of the ideas, you apply them coherently, you don't settle for second best, you go for the gold standard, you lock in the public policy settings in an institutional way so that you reduce the chance of reversion. That's a very good illustration of the combination of coherence, courage, conviction, and great ideas. It's a winner.
And bipartisanship played a role here because of Sir Roger, your predecessor,
yes,
from the other party, who was the finance minister before you, and you sort of made it a common goal.
Right.
That, too, is an elusive goal. I was thinking back to other examples. The people would say Ronald Reagan and Tip O'Neill would have a beer at night. Maybe, but they sure didn't say the same things during the daytime hours. Mm. How did that happen?
Well, it happened by force of circumstance. New Zealand knew that we had to engage in radical reform. The market reforms were starting to pay dividends. I was able to address the unfinished business that Sir Roger was not able to achieve in his party. And we were then rescued by, if you like, success from reversing. Mm. So if you take something that is just sacred to New Zealand politicians, which is free trade. Now, New Zealand is the original author of the Trans-Pacific Partnership. It started with us. We were the first country in the world to sign a free trade agreement with China that was promoted by a successive Labour government. You know, we sign up to policies that work. That's not to say there are not disputes, and that's not to say that there is a certain complacency around those settings, and that's not to say that there aren't at the margins populists who would like to blow up those policy settings. The really comforting thing is they get no electoral traction.
Good. And as we look at that region of the world that we know so little about, we should know more. Of course, we are familiar with China's expansionist mm-hmm. policies, the North Korean mm-hmm. lunacy, all kinds of things. And Australia, as you pointed out, is not doing that well financially. Are you worried about that, about your region, about your hemisphere, as opposed to just New Zealand?
You've got to do risk management. I'm on the board of the Bank of China in New Zealand. I'm a Chinese-appointed director on the publicly listed company, the Infant Formula Company. I work in and with China a lot. We have set the scene for it to be, as the Chinese would say, win-win in a trade sense. They are very keen to invest in New Zealand, and in turn for us to sell them the goods and services that they value in China. So when we're selling infant formula, we're not selling milk, we're selling trust.
Mm-hmm.
So the trust issue is very important. We can't be naive, however, about the risks that exist, the adventurism of China, just as the adventurism of Russia to prowl mm-hmm. around the borders and overreach is not welcome. And it undermines their ability to be seen as a citizen that can be, trusted as a trading partner. So I'm not going to this with an unblinkered view. We have to manage the risks. There are huge opportunities for doing business in China. As I often say, they've just bought 50% of the country's biggest meat exporting company.
Mm-hmm.
People worry. My answer to that is we've got the recipe. We've got an integrity in our food quality. We've got very high value in the products that we produce for their market. We've got the recipe and they've got the readies. I mean, part of the problem of New Zealand and Australia is we don't generate sufficient investment through our own economic activity. We're reliant on savings of others.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, China's got a lot of savings
and
keen to deploy them. But this is like everything else. It's a risk management strategy on our part.
And I'm wondering, just thinking of the geography, the simple geography of it, New Zealand, we would have thought in the old days, we would have said, oh, they're way out there, far, no neighbors, and that's an economic disadvantage. But probably it's an advantage, too. You have no enemies on your borders. I mean, almost everybody else does.
Yeah.
Probably takes your defense spending down somewhat. And you can move around the world nimbly, exporting as you do.
It so suits the temper of the times. The temper of the times is about innovation, which fuels the abundance of modern life. And so our ability to be at the edge, innovating like crazy, pioneering, like signing free trade agreements with mm-hmm. countries that nobody else would contemplate first, winning that first advantage of being in a free trade arrangement. So we have to overcome the distance by being really edgy. Edgy in public policy, which is why we pioneered. I mean, we were the first to have independent central banks with inflation targeting.
Yeah,
the first to have fiscal rules. The first to have a genuine labour market code where you were free to work. The first to apply generally accepted accounting practice to the whole of the public domain. And an interesting first now, which is to apply the investment approach to dysfunctional families. So if you look at state spending, a big part of that is driven by unhappily failure, and failure that hits families, which ends up in crime, drugs, prison, lack of education, is a huge cost. So instead of waiting for the disaster to occur, the dysfunction to fester, and spend $10 million, we're profiling those families and spending $1 million before the disaster happens. And we're able to do that because we take an investment approach to not just our physical and financial capital, but our human capital as well. So it's that edginess that makes New Zealanders, we're pretty, cocky and confident in a sense about, pioneering in public policy settings, and it's paid off for us hugely.
Well, Ruth Richardson, the next time I sit in front of a rack of lamb, of New Zealand lamb, because that's what we have in Canada, before I enjoy it, I will look at it with great respect. I'll know something about it.
And the other thing that you should do is I chair the New Zealand Merino Company, and we make the wonderful active outdoor wear icebreaker, smart wool.
All right.
All of that is made in New Zealand. So lamb and wool.
All righty.
Good choice.
So, thank you. So long life and good luck.
Thank you.
Ruth Richardson. And now here's something else coming up on The World Show.
We should all thank capitalism when we go to the supermarket. Mm-hmm. 30,000 products. The aisles are wide. It's well lit. It's open 24/7, unlike anything government does. But nobody thanks free markets in this. We just take it for granted.
Yes.
And that's the problem. And successful as it's been, when the new thing comes, the politicians will try to stop it. I mean, Uber and Airbnb are good examples of companies that didn't have any infrastructure. They're not like a pharmaceutical plant that takes 10 years to build and you have to get permission first. Mm-hmm. This was the permissionless innovation. And by the time they needed permission, they were huge and had billions so they could lobby against the politicians. Still, Uber, despite being vastly better than the cab system, gets banned in Austin by the trendy people, trendy politicians there.
Ruth Richardson was our guest this week on Free Markets, the Fierce series of The World Show. I'm Bob Scully. Have a great week. Thanks.
Bob Scully's World Show was brought to you by Fiera Capital. The power of thinking, optimal performance, intelligent innovation.